The Dream Quest of Velet Bo is a new sci-fi novel. Excuse me, it's actually a novella. It's a very slim little volume, and on the cover is an illustration of a woman standing in darkness. Her gray hair is pulled back in a ponytail. She's alone on a hilltop with a walking stick in hand. Stars flicker majestically overhead, and a world sleeps down below. This is the picture of an adventurer, the lone traveler at the center of a science fiction fantasy. But if you're not used to seeing a woman with gray hair in that role, you're not alone. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And today we'll talk to Kij Johnson, the Lawrence-based writer who's getting lots of attention for this book, which breaks several unspoken rules of the genre. Hi, Kij.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thanks for asking.
So tell me about the protagonist of this novel and your relationship to her.
Velet Bo is the protagonist, and she is, at the time of this story, a 57-year-old college professor at a women's college in the Dreamlands, who ends up having to retrieve one of her former students who has absconded with a man from the waking world. So she's going to, she's me, essentially, except that she lives in this other world. She ends up going on an adventure, and it turns out that she has this long, colorful past, which turns out to be very productive, it turns out.
It's useful that she was not kind of a cookie-cutter college professor.
Right, right.
Well, so this is based in an unusual sort of way on an existing sci-fi plot line, but also kind of its opposite. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. This was a direct response to The Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith by H.P. Lovecraft, who was a really well-known horror and science fiction writer in the early 20th century. But he's also really, really, really racist. And his sexism, which is very prominent, well, it's not prominent, that's the point. It doesn't show up. There are no women in his stories. And I had always loved him as a little girl, but I had never quite understood what was both attracting me and repelling me to it. And I realized finally as I grew to be an adult and started thinking about representation that what bothered me is that there was nobody for me to be. There was no place that...
Because that's the whole idea of a fantasy.
Right, yeah, that I couldn't insert myself anywhere. And so I had to read it as a little girl and imagine this, but always as though I was watching it. I was never able to just fall into it. So as I've gotten older, I've gotten very interested in thinking about, well, why did these guys do this? And they're usually guys. Why did they write these stories? And so I set out to say, what is the inversion of the Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith, which is a guy, a young man who is a master dreamer traveling
across... This is the original.
Yeah, this is the original. A young man traveling across a fantasy land, but he's from our world. And ultimately, to spoil it for everybody, he realizes that what he loved, he had all along, which we can just hear the quotation marks around that. So I wanted to write a story that was about all the other things. What it's like to be a woman, what it's like to be older, what is it to come to adventure late in life, and what compromises are made, and what advantages come from that.
What do you think, I mean, the initial response you'd had to Lovecraft's stories was love, and that there was something uneasy just in not being able to insert yourself into the fantasy, but you were attracted to it as well. And it seems like a big part of what you've done in addition to inverting things is preserving what you loved. So what is it that you loved and wanted to keep the same?
I grew up in Iowa, which is really flat. I mean, we think Kansas is flat, but out here on the east side, we're not. Iowa was really, really flat, and it was big skies, and that's what we had. So I would dream about adventure, big adventures, fascinating places, strange cities with like domes, onion domes on the buildings instead of little shops that were two stories tall. And that, what attracted me was just the wonder of that, that the notion that anything is possible. There are monsters that walk in the, you know, in the darkness. There's an underworld. I loved that.
And so when you went to write, I mean, this is, I should say, not your first you've been writing science fiction for a while, but this novella is getting a lot of attention. It was one of NPR's best books of 2016. It's a finalist for the Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards. You've also been nominated for a couple of other really big science fiction awards just very recently. And so to focus on this one, what is it that you were going to do to take us on that kind of a journey, the kind of journey you always loved?
I wanted to write a story that that allowed me to be both an adult in full maturity and sensible and still have an adventure. And that's one of the things. I read a lot of fantasy and things because I teach. And so I read a lot of things, and young people, they make stupid mistakes and they have these big adventures. But a lot of times what gets them through is either dumb luck or just sort of animal spirits and strength. What got me through writing this is I wanted to think about what it's like to be cunning, what it's like to be smart and have an adventure. What decisions would you make that are different? And there are a lot of Easter eggs in Dream Quest of Velet Bow that point to the Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith, because the young male protagonist makes a lot of stupid mistakes that my protagonist never does. She walks away from the same problems.
The professor often, as she's on this adventure, where she's traveling from a dream world to our world to try and retrieve the student who's kind of run away in the dark of night. And as the professor is on this journey, which is incredibly dangerous, she's often remembering her previous travels from her young life. I wonder what you think is the role of memory in this kind of adventure.
Often it doesn't turn up. In fantasies, a lot of times, big, heroic, epic fantasies, memory and history are important. The notion that there was an empire and now it's gone, or like Lord of the Rings, there's these thousands of years of history behind it. But one of the things that a lot of times they don't talk about is personal memories, because people are 20. What I've got with my character, because she's in her 50s, she has had two lifetimes behind her where different things, she's done different things, and all of these things become part, because as I have adventures as an older woman, I notice that my memories of driving this road come back and they overlay my current driving adventures.
So when you said earlier that this character in some ways is you, can you tell me more about that?
I loved reading things. I was not an athletic little girl at all, and I was not an athletic adult. And when I was 45, I discovered rock climbing, and I started bouldering especially, which is really climbing without ropes and is dumb and hazardous when your bones are getting soft. So I had a lot of injuries, but I adored it. And one of the things I came up against again and again is people saying, oh, you're so brave for doing this at your age. And I was like, well, the only difference between me now and me at 20 is that I'm willing to now. And so I thought a lot about what it is to be older and start having adventures.
Why are you willing now and you weren't then?
I really don't know. I think there was a moment that I realized that life does not arrange itself the way you think it does when you're young. And so the hazards, things like breaking my bones or something like that, just wasn't that important to me compared to the payoff of the gratification of what I was doing and the things that I felt while I was doing it. So I look at Velet and I think she's a lot like me, because she has had a very interesting early youth, but she's been very sedate for a long time, but she's always kind of missed it. And now she comes back to it.
But reluctantly.
Yeah, she starts reluctant. Although I have to say, she still has all of her stuff stored in her closet. So even though she hasn't gone on a crazy hike for 30 years, she still owns her machete. She still owns her hiking boots and all of her emergency gear.
So she's been probably anticipating that there's some part of her that might want to sneak back out?
Yeah, maybe. There is a sort of nostalgia for the things that we've done in the past. We keep like old equipment from, you know, our kite surfing days or something like that.
So she teaches at an all-women's university, and in the context of this world, this is still sort of a precarious thing. Can you explain that?
My assumption, the Dreamlands are built built on the dreams of dreamers, usually male dreamers from our world. So the dreamlands are essentially nostalgic, mostly in the Lovecraft stories. They point back to the youths of these young of these men, now grown old, and they reconstruct Cornwall because they can't get back, but they remember it nostalgically. So memory does play in that to that extent. So my assumption is that the dreamlands are quite in behind us. And I went with sort of a notion of the 30s, Oxford in the 30s, the idea that women are allowed in school, but they're really never going to be as good as anybody else. And they really have to manage themselves so that they don't poison the well for the women to come after.
And so when the main character, forgive me if I get her last name pronunciation wrong, Claire Gerot?
Yeah, Clarie Gerot.
Clarie Gerot. She... You know, she's a star student. She's in the math department, and the professor is awakened by another student knocking on her door, frantic that Claire is missing. Clarie, that's going to be hard for me to get used to.
It is for everybody, including the copy editor.
Yeah, because when you read it, you get it in your head. Anyway, she's awakened, and she goes to find the whole dorm full of women just really pretty reluctant to show that they have anything to do with this, but they're also very curious, like, why is this other student missing? She's left a note, but there's an observation that the professor makes that I think is so interesting in this context, which is that when she kind of calms the students down, she sees a look on their faces that reveals the older women they will be someday.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you experience as a professor?
Yes, actually. This has been a very hard year for a lot of students, and I've had a fair number of them in my office talking about it. And when we are tired, young or old, we look older than we are. And you'll see the lines, where the crow's feet will end up, or where the weariness will settle on their foreheads. And it's a little unsettling. When I was young, I didn't notice. I would just look at it and say, oh, we look really haggard because we were out too late last night. But now I look at it and I think that is who this person may become. You know, she may grow into those wrinkles, or they may just be an exception to the character that she becomes as she grows older.
But that's such an interesting counterpoint to the idea that this older woman is finally discovering adventure, because it seems like, in a way, what you're saying is that the tired self is the older self.
In some ways, yeah. The older I get, the more tired I am pretty consistently.
But so back to this idea, the women's college is in this precarious position of having to sort of prove that it belongs in this world. And when this star pupil disappears, the reason that there's so much at stake here is not just because of her. A student could run away and that affects her and the people who love her, but also that it seems like that might imperil the very existence of this university.
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening. If a woman whose father was not trustee, which Clarie Gerot's father is, but an ordinary student were to run away, the scandal could be concealed. But this is what they're afraid of, is that the women will come to university and they will behave in scarlet ways and wear lipstick and, you know, their skirts above the knee and things like that. So the fear is that any woman, any scandal that a woman student is involved in could allow the trustees of the university as a whole to just say, why are we even doing this? In her case, it's worse because her father is a trustee of the college, which is a subset of the university. So if he takes it personally, if he's angry that they didn't watch his baby better, then the college could be shut down. But then it turns out that because of her grandfather, the university as a whole could go through much, much worse things. But it's really just an extreme case of what could have happened if any woman student had run away with a man.
So there's tension here, though, between freedom for this one young woman and freedom for women in general. This young woman wants to go to what's called the waking world.
Right, yeah. That's exactly the issue. And one of the questions I was thinking about a lot while I was writing this is the balance between individual freedom and our need to represent. So Clarie gets to be you know, gets to be a bright thinker and stuff, but she also has to be a representative and has to stand up for all of the other women who are at college who maybe don't have her opportunities. You know, Clary will, because she's beautiful and brilliant and talented and all of these other things are going on, Clary will have whatever life she wants. And in fact, she has a very interesting life, it turns out. But the other women, the ones who are maybe not quite as bright, maybe not quite as beautiful, maybe they won't ever get married or be beloved, those women, she has to do the right thing for all those women, as well as balancing what she wants for herself.
So these women basically live in what would be the dream world of H.P. Lovecraft. So like the dream world of this previous generation of man is this sort of past time place. And we think of dreams as, you know, what you want, what you hope for. But these women in some way are trapped in the dream.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting insight, because the dreamland, as I'm hypothesizing it and as Lovecraft writes about it, it's created by men dreamers. And that means that women fit into this dreamland that they have constructed to whatever extent the men are thinking about where women fit in the world. In Lovecraft's case, there just weren't any because he didn't care. But I think that in my case, I was more interested in thinking about, but if that's a real place, these men think they made it up, but maybe they didn't. And if so, then where are all the people and all of the parts of the world that they don't know anything about?
Your book is dedicated to anyone who's ever had to find her own way in. And that makes me wonder about when you have had to find your own way in. Have you had to find your own way into science fiction?
My parents both read science fiction, so I always had, there was always a lot of it around the house, and we were always reading it all. But absolutely, a lot of it was, I read, but the older I got, the more I had trouble. So when I read Lord of the Rings for the first time, and there are only a few female characters who have any importance at all, and they are an elf princess, another elf princess, and a young woman who mopes about a man. And I was like, I was really young. I was like 9, and I had no interest. I knew I wasn't an elf princess, and I had no interest in moping about a man. So I would imagine that Mary, one of the two hobbits who travels with Frodo, was a girl, because the name Mary, M-E-R-R-Y, was practically like Mary. I thought, I could have adventures with these people. So I did that a lot.
How did you get into writing science fiction?
I didn't start until I was in my 20s. And I was just trying some different hobbies. It was weird. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I needed something to do with my life that was fun. So I tried calligraphy and I tried quilting and I took a science fiction writing class at a community college, and that clicked. And then I just never stopped writing, and then I got more and more serious about it.
So what was your first, when you say that, you know, you got more and more serious, what would you say was your first serious piece of science fiction?
The first thing I wrote that won an award was only a couple of years after I started writing, and it was a very short story called Fox Magic, which was a fantasy, medieval Japanese fantasy, about a shape-changing fox that falls in love with a man. She takes on human form to seduce him away from his wife. Things do not go well, because they never do. That was probably the first serious thing.
Things never go well?
Not when you're a shape-changing fox in love with a human, they don't. Probably the most important recent thing, I wrote a story called 26 Monkeys, also The Abyss, which is available online. And that story was a nonlinear story about a woman who sort of inherits a traveling circus show, a traveling fair show, which is 26 monkeys that at the end of their act, which is sort of slightly more better than normal monkeys, they can build a suspension bridge. She ends up, the final act is that they all climb into a bathtub and they vanish, and she doesn't know where they go. And so the story is sort of amusing about her life, but also with this strange mystery at the center of it.
Something that is hard for me to imagine as someone who does not write science fiction is, like, when I do something creative, I feel like the constraints kind of help me. Like, the constraints of the real world keep me grounded. And so I can, I don't know, exercise my creativity within kind of a clearly defined space. And in science fiction, where even just, you know, I don't know whether foxes remain foxes is up for, you know, they might not. They might shift shape and shape shift. But you know what I'm saying?
Like,
how do you deal with anything is possible?
Well, science fiction and fantasy are, if they're done well, I believe are very rigorous. Because we have the same requirements of realistic characterization and lucid or luminous prose. But we also have these additional rules, like what is it like if you live 1,000 years? Now we have to think that through as though it were real, which means that we do a huge amount of developmental work that, if we do our job right, embeds itself in the story. You're right that anything is possible, but not anything is possible in any story. So we do adhere, we apply constraints, and then we adhere to the sort of fallout that comes from those constraints. It's not easy, I will say.
So you make the world and its rules first?
Sometimes the rules evolve. In the case of Velvet Bow, it was very easy to know what the rules were because they were basically everything I could get away with within what Lovecraft had already said. But in other stories...
And some of the characters are the same.
Right. Yeah, some of the characters
there's
are.
Like
so I had to make them...
gatekeeper character who reappears.
Yeah, Nosht. And then there's the, Randolph Carter, who's actually the protagonist of the original Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith. So I bring several characters, and I can't break who they are because... that would be cheating by my mind. But nevertheless, I want to subvert them. I want them to be not the people that we think they are.
But is that partly because they are older, just like the...
Yeah, that's part of it. They are, although Randolph Carter, because he's from the waking world, he doesn't age the way she does. And that's towards the end of it when she does meet him. She's in her 50s and he still looks like he's in his 20s. And that brings up like a whole different layer, because they were lovers, that brings up a whole layer of how do we end up in this, these respective corners of this room.
The, I mean, that's when you think about something like, I don't know, Hollywood, that's kind of the reality we live in some ways.
I think that's true. Hollywood in movies, I'm very interested in representation of older characters because I'm really tired of seeing, you know, people in their 50s always wearing a frumpy floral thing because they're a mom and that's the only role you get to be, or maybe a grandma if you're lucky. And I really have trouble sometimes with television, with Hollywood in general. But then there are shows that really do it well, like Person of Interest, where most of the characters were in their 40s and up, unapologetically the ages they were. They weren't faking being younger or anything like that. So you got to see what smart, cunning people would do in the same situations that ordinarily a young person would have.
Back to the Dream Quest of Velvet Bow, the novella that you've written, it's not just an empowering picture of an older person in that she's off on an adventure and doing it really well. She also does feel her age.
Yeah, her back is always hurting through that entire story. I don't talk about it all the time because it's a little tedious, as anybody who has a chronic bad back knows, to feel it, let alone talk about it. But yeah, there are things she cannot do anymore. She cannot climb the same things she used to be able to climb. Yeah, absolutely.
Was it important to you to include that aspect of aging? Because it is a really empowering thing to see that the cover of a fantasy is a woman with gray hair and a backpack on.
Yeah. Well, I actually wanted her to be carrying a machete, so I thought
so
that would be even better. That would have been even better.
Agreed.
But I do think that that's part of it. I mean, who we are physically and mentally and emotionally, that's a package. And a young person brings strength and vigor and the ability to sleep on rocks, but they also don't bring decades of experience in negotiating. So you get the packet. Your back hurts more, but you can now negotiate with anybody.
So obviously in the awards world, you're getting a great response to this novella, but just from individual readers who you've met or been contacted by, what are some of the things you're hearing about this different kind of hero.
I love the feedback I get. I'm very easy to find online, so I get a lot of emails from people, a lot of women just saying, I'm so grateful to see somebody actually doing something cool. And women of all ages, so young women, older women, a lot of people will respond to a specific moment. One of the things Velit's very aware of is that 20 years before, if she traveled and she didn't want men to make passes at her, she wore her hair short, she wore frumpy clothes, and now nobody notices her whether she wants them to or not. And that's both liberating and a little unsettling for her. And that's something that a number of people have written to me about and said, oh my goodness, that's exactly what happened to me. I turned 45 and it's like I became invisible. And that's been a pretty common comment.
Yeah, there's a moment where there's some travelers who have some wonderful smelling stuff. They're trading
spice spices. Merchants, yeah.
And I wondered, there's no commentary there. It's just that they don't notice her, and so but I kind of got the feeling that maybe she would have liked to interact, to smell those spices a little more closely.
I think that's true, and I think in 20 years before she would have. It would. She's traveling alone as a woman most of the time in this story, and she's traveling surrounded by men. And most of the time, all the men ignore her, which I think she's more used to having conversations. She's more used to negotiating them wanting things from her that she's not going to give them, but interacting and being able to have conversations than just them not wanting anything from her. So she can't have the everyday conversations she would have worked her way towards.
Have you heard from male readers?
Yeah, a fair number of men have liked it as well. There have been a few people who say, well, I don't understand why this had to happen. You know, Lovecraft was perfectly good, but most people really liked the fact that I was sort of interrogating the whole package. And it has a lot of sort of statements about race as well. So I've had a lot of commentary about it's the race statement is much subtler. Velt Bo is actually a woman of color. She has very, very short braids. She has her hair corded by the end. And she's copper color. Her skin is copper colored. And most of the women students are women of color, which is never foregrounded, but is important. And a lot of readers have noticed that and then sort of drawn whatever conclusions they wanted from it. But yeah, there have been men who've really liked it.
Kish Johnson, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me. It was fantastic.
Kish Johnson wrote The Dream Quest of Velit Bo, and she's with us from KU. Up next, The Human Spine is Older Than We Thought. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and a fossil was recently discovered in Ethiopia that gives us a new understanding of the human spine. One of the researchers who's been part of that discovery is joining us now. Carol Ward is a professor of pathology and anatomy at MU. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Happy to be here.
Good. Well, so tell me about this discovery, just what it is.
You bet. This is an absolutely astonishing little fossil. It's the skull and a part of a skeleton of a child that lived almost three and a half million years ago. The little child was about 2.5 years old. We call her Salam, which means peace in the Amharic language. And she gives us the most complete spinal column for any of our early human ancestors, along with a lot of other great information.
So how old, I mean, I know that this was a toddler in life, but like how old is this fossil?
Well, the fossil itself is dated to about 3.3 million years ago from the site in Ethiopia.
Man, okay. So how does this is the oldest complete spine that we have of a human ancestor. But tell me more about like what we know now from this spine that we either didn't know before or just knew incorrectly.
Well, you bet. We just didn't know before. Until this fossil was found, the earliest evidence we had for a complete human spine was only about 60,000 years old for Neanderthals. So this pushes it over 3 million years back in the past. And it's really interesting and important to us because the spine is sort of fundamental to the unique way that humans stand up and walk around the world on 2 feet. And that was really the hallmark of human evolution, that transition to walking upright on 2 feet. And the spine is part of that because it holds us upright. We know that apes African apes, so chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, our closest living relatives, have 13 rib-bearing vertebrae in their back at a very short lower back region. And that gives them a really stiff spine, which helps them move about the trees. Humans have a long, flexible lower back and only 12 pairs of ribs and vertebrae that bear those ribs. So we can move our hips and walk smoothly and effectively on 2 feet. But until we found this little fossil, we weren't sure when that kind of transition took place from ape-like to human-like. And now we know it goes back to some of our very earliest ancestors.
So when did you first get involved in this whole process with this fossil?
Well, this fossil is pretty amazing because it was actually found in about 2006 by my colleague Zerai Alamseged and his team at a site called Dikika in Ethiopia. And it was found in a block of sandstone. So this little child would have gotten washed away in a flood and buried and then recovered in a block. And it took an expert preparator with little tiny dental drills and picks 13 years to remove the sandstone from around all these little tiny bones. And then even so, we couldn't pull the spine apart. So we took it up to the particle accelerator called a synchrotron in Grenoble and removed them all digitally. And I came into the picture when Zerai realized that there was actually a spine and ribs and parts of the body that I study. So he brought me into the picture only 2 or 3 years after it was found. It just took this long to be able to actually see the anatomy of these tiny bones.
But so how do you do something like removing a spine from its fossilized sandstone? How do you do that digitally? That doesn't make sense to me on the face of it.
Well, it wouldn't. We take as much of the sand off physically as we can. But even so, these little tiny bones, which are only about half an inch across, couldn't be separated physically. So we can put them in, it's sort of like a medical CT scanner when somebody goes to the doctor and they have a scan. We can take those images, put them in the computer, and use digital tools to digitally remove the rest of the sand that we can't remove physically. So we can have an image of each little tiny bone on its own. And then we can see what it looks like and study what its shape is and learn something about it.
You know, people listening to this, I think maybe because this is the spine of a child, maybe that's why, but it feels a little like some of the language around this, like, and so then we had to like pull the spine apart and stuff like that. You know, you are used to it because this is the field you work in. How do you separate what sounds like it was probably a pretty awful story? I mean, there's something happened to this two and a half year old. How do you separate that from the excitement of everything you're discovering thanks to this spine?
Well, we are aware of that. And in some ways, it's sort of like making something good for humanity out of what was a tragedy 3.5 million years ago. It would have been a terrible event. Some parent would have lost their child. It would have been tragic. And for us to be able to see this little child and have the child now give back to humanity and give back to science by teaching us something about what they would have been like and what our early ancestors would have been like, in some ways is giving it a tribute to what maybe happened in the past.
So as you study this spine, what do you see in it? What do you understand?
Well, the first thing we see is that this little child, Salam, had 12 pairs of ribs just like we do. So 12 little vertebrae that the ribs would attach to, and that's different from an ape. So we can see that she would have been built just like you or I would be in terms of how our spine is constructed, which means that she would have had the spine that was designed to walk fully upright on 2 feet and move around like you or me. And that's a big deal because you sort of have this idea that our ancestors are kind of half ape and half human and really different. In terms of how they stood and move, we now know that they would have been just as upright as we are. So that's pretty a big deal.
What do you think makes you, of all spine people in the world, the one who is turned to for your analysis?
Well, I've published on a number of other fossils that tell us something about the evolution of the spine. And these fossils are few and far between enough that there are really only a handful of us in the world that are experts on this bit of anatomy. One of the things that I've been involved in studying is that the anatomy of that transition and the kind of vertebra that has ribs to the kind that are in your lower back and give you back pain now was different in our ancestors, but we didn't know how to place that transition where it was along the column because we only had a couple bones here, a couple bones there. And I've been trying to chase that question down for decades. And with this fossil, it answers some of the questions I've had. And I was one of the people really trying to answer those questions. So it all came together.
Where does your passion for the evolution of the spine come from?
Well, I'm really interested in understanding where we came from as humans. And to me, the story of human evolution, like any good story, starts at the beginning. So I'm really interested in the origins of our lineage and those earliest transitions from our ape forebears to what we are today. So since the spine is so fundamental to how we move about the world and the fact that we humans move about the world unlike any other animal, that transition is a really important one. And if we can figure out how and why that took place, then we get a window on maybe why that might have happened. And that's a really hard question to answer, and I don't have the answers. But only when we figure out all the whats can we start to answer the whys. And so I think it's a really exciting puzzle.
When you first, I mean, have you been able to handle this spine in Ethiopia?
Absolutely. I've been over and worked on the fossil itself several times in the museum. It's housed at the National Museum of Ethiopia in Addis Ababa, which is the capital of Ethiopia. So I've been over there several times, and I've seen all the little spine all stuck together and helped interpret what it looked like. And I've also worked with the digital images right here in Columbia, Missouri.
What is it like to handle something like that, that not only holds the key to so many unanswered questions, but also just, I mean, you're connecting physically with humans from millions of years ago. That's crazy to me.
It is. And I remember the first time I saw one of these fossils, it was long before this one was discovered. It gives you chills because no one has seen these animals for millions of years. There are no animals living today that are like these animals. So you've got something from the past that no one's seen before. And then you're one of the very few people in the world that's privileged enough to be able to hold it, to be able to look at it, to be able to try to figure out what it looked like and start to think about what would it have done, what would it have sounded like or moved like or felt like or been like. And so you get the sort of time machine going in your head when you look at it to try to figure out what that would have been like. It's really fun.
It sounds like, I mean, not only does this change how old the spine is, at least our understanding of that, but it might also change our understanding of how old humans are.
Well, in a way, we know that there were members of our branch of the family tree that go back to at least 4 million years ago and maybe almost six. But they're sort of, the more you go back in time, the more ape-like they are. But the first group of animals that we know really stood up and walked around like us is this group of species called Australopithecus, which is a big mouthful. It means southern ape. It was found in South Africa originally. And these are the animals that are really the ones that show that big change in how they negotiated the world, how they would have gotten from place to place, what they could have held, what they could have done when they got there. So that's a really key transition, a really key time. And the more we learn about these animals, the better. And to find something from the spine it's unprecedented. We've never had anything quite like this that's so complete.
Carol Ward with us from the Department of Pathology and Anatomical Sciences at the University of Missouri. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Next up, the band Soul Revival. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for KCUR's Central Standard. The band Soul Revival has a new EP, and I'm just going to guess that this song is the hit. It's called Fall in Love. I'm here with Soul Revival's Derek Moore and Desmond Mason, D. Professor Desmond
Mason. Yes.
Derek is the vocalist. Hi, Derek.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Pretty good. Glad to be here.
And Desmond is the keyboardist. Hey, Desmond.
Hey.
So congratulations on this new EP. Tell me about this song.
Thank you very much. Fall in Love is a feel-good kind of dance groove that Desmond created, and I kind of started writing to, and it's just been a fun process just to watch it grow and develop.
It's the jam for the summer. Put this on at your barbecue.
So how did your release party at the Buffalo Room over the weekend go?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful and humbling to have all the support of our fans there at that spot, and the concert was wonderful. And nothing more to say.
How long has Soul Revival been around?
Desmond and I started around fall of 2015 of writing original music, and then I kind of started the group doing like cover shows around the city probably 2014.
The soul music scene in Kansas City, is there a lot of original soul music being created here?
I would probably say I've seen more soul R&B recently, but I think before that, not really.
Yeah, not really from my view.
How did you guys take me back to your meeting?
I was part of this band called Shades of Jade, headed by Josh Williams. It was a jazz fusion group. As far as the recording artist side, we recorded that one with that group featuring Derek on vocals, and Josh wrote the song. And I started creating tracks at that time, and he heard them and he said, you know, hey, Desmond, would you be interested in doing original music? And I said, sure. So I just started sending him tracks and he started writing. And that was that. He could tell you more about the cover band aspect.
Please do.
Yeah. So backing up a few years, when I first did a Soul Revival show, it was at Green Lady Lounge, and, I had asked Eddie Moore to be a part of the from Eddie Moore and the Outer Circle. I asked him to be a part of and play keys, and he couldn't do it. And so he actually referred me to Desmond, and that was the first time he and I kind of met each other and kind of connected musically. And so since then, I've always just respected his craft and just the ability to connect with how he plays and kind of where my mind and takes me vocally and musically. And so. It was just when I reached out to Desmond, it was really just the perfect fit, I thought. And so it has been so far. So, yeah.
Desmond, what's your personal history with soul music?
My personal history consists of being influenced by Music Soul Child, Anthony Hamilton, Jill Scott, that generation of music. Combine that with my jazz influence and my hip-hop influence, you know, that just makes me who I am in soul music, and it influences my production.
What do you think about the relationship between these genres? I mean, you've named three just now, soul, hip-hop, and jazz.
I think they're intertwined, especially in the era of music that I came up in. You know, there were elements of hip-hop, especially like in Music Soul Child's, you know, music. There's always been a hint of improvisation in Jill Scott's music, for example. So they all intertwine in some sort of way, you know, from time to time, you know, and that's just music.
Let's listen to a little more music. This song from the new EP is called Key to My Heart, and this one's got some interesting horn stylings, and it's also really like a pretty, I don't know, it's a pretty unusual song. It doesn't quite fit the pop mold. Let's give a listen. So that horn is really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
This song is I had wrote earlier this year, and Josh Williams is actually playing the horns you hear there, and it's really about just a woman who has a key to your heart, and you don't want to let her go, and you have to communicate that and bring her back. And so it's just that story.
Yeah.
Tell me about your use of the horn here.
Josh had already had a hand in producing this song. This song is the only song on the EP mostly produced by Derek Cunningham. I contributed some keyboards and some bass, but Josh wrote the whole arrangement. And when it came to putting it on the EP, you know, we had asked Josh, you know, do you want to keep the horns on there? And he said yes. And I thought that it added a vibe to the song, and that's how we kept it.
It seems like it adds really a pretty strong jazz vibe to the song. And we've talked a little bit about the overlapping genres that come through here, even though you've got a band called Soul Revival.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What do you think about, just as far as live music in Kansas City and people discovering different music, how can the audiences branch out more to come in better contact with things that are maybe outside their wheelhouses? Are there barriers to that, or?
I think there's so much music here in Kansas City, so much history. I think people almost just need to come outside of their homes and branch out a little more. There's literally like on an average weekend, especially now it's, you know, warmer, it's music happening every weekend. And so wherever the location is, just go out and experience your city and see what it has to offer. So
also it's up to us as artists to present this type of music at the shows. For example, I played with this other R&B artist called Lee Langston, a very prominent, you know, R&B person, neo-soul person in the city. And he explained to me that was one of his goals as well, is to present music that people may not know and then educate the audiences to where, you know, they could go to that music on their own. So I think it's up to us, like Lee Langston, like Soul Revival, to present that music towards audiences as well and educate them as to where they can find it. And then they'll find it.
Does soul music need a revival?
I think it's gotten lost along the way. Desmond's kind of explained his influence. I would add to that, mine are more Luther Vandross, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Isley Brothers. That's where kind of my background comes into play. And I think it's not, it doesn't always get the attention that it deserves sometimes, yes. But just in the current state of music. And so I would say yes. The record Fall in Love is done well for us, and it's almost refreshing is some of the feedback that we've gotten to when people hear it and listen to it. So
it's not dead. Definitely, you know, there are still audiences that listen to the music, you know, don't get me wrong, but as far as how prominent it is as in all of music, the music, the soul music,
people often reach back to soul music from the past. That's what I was going to say.
The soul music that's more modern, that has more modern sounds, you know, electronic drums, hints of EDM, for example, hints of hip hop, you know, those types of things are taking the forefront right now. While artists such as Jill Scott or Anthony Hamilton, while they still have a fan base, you know, you don't hardly hear about them. Unless you go on an urban AC radio station, for example. You don't hear them on mainstream radio stations that much anymore.
What about venues? I mean, we heard a song, and I think it's true of this one, too. Like, someone who loves jazz would probably really be into it, but does someone who loves jazz come to the venues where you're performing? Does that person come in contact with your work to know that they would love it?
Well, and I think that's like what Desmond was saying earlier. You know, it's our job as artists to market and promote ourselves and get in front of the audience to spread the word and just bring people to us in our music. And so,
Yeah, and to actually sell the music, you know, personally, you know, in a personable manner, and also to make an undeniable, you know, record as well. That's yeah. what it takes.
Well, we're going out on another song from the new EP. This one's called Come Back. Derek Moore and Desmond Mason from the band Soul Revival, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the stories our houses tell. We'll talk to Kansas Cityans who have dug up the histories of their homes, how they did it, and what they found out on KCUR's Central Standard tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. They ain't been here before, so how would they know? We can't close.